you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
When 20-year-old Emma Agnew stopped responding to messages, alarm bells immediately began to ring for her parents and brothers. This was extremely out of character for her. And being deaf, Emma relied heavily on the phone and was in frequent contact with her family, who she was really close to. 11 days later, her family's worst fears were confirmed. She'd unfortunately crossed paths with a monster. And Emma was not his only victim. These are the appalling crimes of a remorseless predator. This is the case of Liam Reid. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is one that is marked both by its brutality, but also by the preying on a vulnerable young girl. I am not saying that people who are deaf are more vulnerable in society than the average human being. I am saying that it's provocative when individuals who already have a certain set of additional struggles find themselves in scenarios like I'm going to discuss today. Also, I am showcasing my Do Not Comply camo. Please do feel free to have a look over on my website. I have a bit of a gander. Loads of true crime merch there, all made by yours truly. I say yours truly as if I'm the person who's kind of creating. We do create all the designs. We do it all ourselves. We print it all here. We send it all to you. That's why you'll notice that everything's personalised. However, the idea that I'm sat there needling these kind of items myself, that's a lie. I'm saying we happen to have quite a good little industry in my home. And that means that the quality of the T-shirts, the quality of the hoodies that you'll receive will far outweigh other hoodies and T-shirts. I promise you that. When you compare your prices and you look at the quality of ours, way better. And as ever, I love my Do Not Comply, I wear it all the time. I like to think when I go out, people are like, she's a bit of a rebel. At the end of the day, I might be a bit of a rebel, if I'm honest. Let's carry on with today's case. So who was Emma Agnew? So she was born in Christchurch, beautiful area in New Zealand. I loved travelling around New Zealand. I did the North Island, the South Island, and one of my favourite places was Christchurch. So a really safe place. That's how it feels. And she was born to parents, Louise and Henry. She had three brothers, Herbie, Benny and Toby. And what can I say about her family, aside from the fact that ultimately they were so close? They were extremely close. Now, the whole family are deaf and they all communicate through sign language and texting. Emma wasn't somebody who was overly verbal, but she did vocalise some sounds, but it wasn't as if she had a fluent speech. But again, she lives with a family who understand one another. She's surrounded by the deaf community in the deaf society, which means that her experience in the world is exactly the same as yours and mine. Essentially, she had great social support, she had great family support and great communication because of the fact that she was spending a lot of time with individuals who were also hard of hearing. Now, once she'd even travelled to the World Federation of the Deaf Conference in Madrid, so she's an adventurer as well. She's somebody who takes life and runs with it in spite of certain limitations. She was said to be somebody who really enjoyed reading. She loved sport. She loved playing netball. She loved playing rugby. She was really active. And like many young people, she loved music. But her favourite musician was somebody called Cymark. And that's a deaf rap artist. She'd watched him in concert. She owned his DVD. And apparently she would sign along to rap music. I don't know whether any of you have noticed that. In our modern era, there's been a real introduction of cool sign artists at concerts. I see them regularly and they're just getting down and dirty to whatever music is going on. And you really feel that they bring to life for the deaf community the experience of the concert. So when people attend concerts or watch concerts, the truth is, just because you're deaf doesn't mean that you don't experience it. What we know is the vibrational quality that an individual will experience is something that makes them understand music in a different way to somebody who's hearing music, but nonetheless, they are captivated by that. And they're so in tune with vibrations, far more than you or I would be. So she loves this particular type of music, and she obviously is somebody who's quite musical. She was said to be really independent. So she'd moved out of the family home. She'd actually moved into a flat with a friend. And the friend said that Emma was basically like a little sister to her. And Emma was just one of two girls in her class at the Christchurch College of Computing, because what we know is that when it comes down to computer science and when it comes down to coding, it is massively male dominated. So even there, she's standing out because of the fact that she's doing courses that are male dominated, and it also indicates she was very bright. At the end of the day, when it comes down to coding, when it comes down to computer science, you have to be good at maths and you have to have a real linear and logical brain. But also, girls coming into these kind of environments is so powerfully important, because it's 50% of the population are female, and therefore having individuals that create for females is really positive. So she's making her way in the world. And two friends that she actually met on the course, Matt and Andy, they are lovely. Because when I talk about people that I don't know Matt and Andy, clearly. I'm saying they are lovely from my outside looking in. I don't know who they are. But I do know that these two young men learned sign language as a result of meeting Emma. And Andy took multiple night classes a week. It warms my soul to know that there are young people like this in the world. That Emma was so important to them that they didn't just want to be able to communicate on a basic level. They wanted to communicate on her level. And to go ahead and to take multiple night classes so that you can have a better relationship with somebody that you connect with in class, that says something beautiful about you. And it also says something about Emma.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
The way that people must have warmed to her to such a point that they want to build a relationship on an even greater footing. And Matt, well, he described Emma as confident, as self-assured, and he said, listen, yes, she was deaf, but it had no bearing whatsoever on her life. It didn't slow her down at all. Now, on the 15th of November 2007, she just vanishes. And this is highly unusual. So Emma's family very early on realised something is wrong. So they go to the police, they report her as missing. And the reason for this is they haven't actually physically heard from her for over 10 hours. This is unbelievably strange. And the reason for that is she's usually texting them throughout the day. And they said she always had her mobile phone on her. In fact, she had two. And this was her main form of communication. So for her not to be communicating with them in this way is very unusual. And the last time they'd received a message from her was 10:30 that morning. They take it seriously. So it's not as if the authorities think, oh, well, you know, wait another 24 hours. They know there is something unusual about the fact that Emma hasn't been in contact. Later that night, as they're searching, officers find Emma's car in Bromley Park. And it's a scary sight to see, because it's been set alight. So immediately, concern for her well-being dramatically increases upon discovery of this, because you can understand that whilst it's out of context for her not to have been in contact with her family, this is an independent person who's at college, who's living by themselves. To all intents and purposes, she could be hanging out with a guy or hanging out with a girl. She could be having a drink somewhere. There are all these things. Ultimately, she could be doing something that is completely typical of young people her age. So even though the police are taking it seriously and are looking for her, they're probably thinking, chances are she's just living loose and free and it's all going to be okay. And then suddenly they're met with her burning vehicle, and now they know this is sinister. And what they notice straight away is the driver's seat's been set on fire. And apparently, according to investigators, the reason this tends to be done is because they want to remove evidence. So that's why they set that particular seat on fire. Now, the firefighters fortunately managed to put the blaze out before it spreads. Now, even though the interior has got soot in it, it's got dust, obviously, from the flames. Anybody who's ever been involved in a fire knows how dirty it is. And the area surrounding where the car is then searched. Now, they put the luminol down to look at whether there's any blood around, etc. And it reveals drag marks from the car. Now, those drag marks seem to indicate blood, but it's unable at this point to confirm for definite, as luminol can actually detect other substances too. It's presumed it's blood, but they can't absolutely confirm it. And the little amount present that was there meant that it was actually not possible for them to be able to retrieve it as far as a DNA level retrieval is concerned. So it's there, but they can't get enough from it to connect the DNA essentially. Also, they find fingerprints and they also find other evidence that they then take from Emma's car. Now, the numerous prints that they find, they're actually ruled out because they're friends, they're family, they're there for innocent reasons and everybody understands why they would be there. But there is a partial print of the palm of a hand found on the car's exterior, and that can't be accounted for by people known to Emma. Yet, with respect, we all have been in situations where we might have leant against a car and put our hand on it, or we might have had somebody do work on our car and they've put a hand on it. So again, that doesn't necessarily make you think there's something sinister has happened or that the person who has put that print on the car is involved in anything sinister. Because like I said, there are lots of reasons why a handprint could be on the exterior of a car. But it does provide the investigators essentially with a line of inquiry because they want to be able to try and match this print, mainly to exclude the person from their inquiries, as opposed to bringing somebody in thinking, well, that print will be the individual who's carried out this particular crime, whatever that crime may be. They also take hairs from the car and they find a pubic hair in the back passenger seat, and they note that that doesn't, when they do test, belong to Emma. But again, I'm going to throw it out there, just because you find somebody's pubic hair in the back of your car doesn't mean that something terrible's happened to you, because young people have sex in the back of the cars. Your friends might even get down and dirty in the back of your car. There are reasons why you can find such items in the back. We've all been young. We've all had very few places to go in certain moments, and that has led at times to us making the less romantic decisions regarding where we will practice our intimate lives. So it isn't completely left field that that would be the case, but I can imagine that for the investigators, they're starting to think to themselves, right, the car's been found on fire, there's a pubic hair in the back of the car that doesn't belong to Emma, and she's disappeared. So what we could be looking at is a sexually motivated attack, and we could be looking at a potential homicide. Now, they look at the timeline and establish how Emma has moved around during the day of her disappearance. So first of all, in the morning, she visits one of her friends before going to work. She then sends a work email at 9:53 a.m. and then she leaves work for some time after this. She had spoken to her parents that day via text, and she was actually in the process of trying to sell her car. So she told her mum that she was speaking to a man who was interested in buying it and who actually wanted to take it for a test drive. Now, you can imagine that alarm bells go off in the investigators' minds when they're hearing about a potential meeting up of a strange person she doesn't know to go on a test drive with them, particularly when the car has now turned up on fire. Now, there's a press conference on November the 16th, 2007. This was held where Emma's brother, Toby, and father, Henry, actually sat there and asked for information from the public. And they did that using sign language, which is just heartbreaking, isn't it? Because their one means of communication, which is desperation, love, passion, which will all be present, because they aren't saying it, sometimes it means that people won't hear the panic and horror that clearly exists. But this press conference tries to convey just how desperate the family is. So they're asking for information to come from the public. Henry said, using sign language, Emma loves her family and her family loves her, that she's a very good girl with many friends in the community. And the Deaf Association, they even set up a fund to find Emma. It raised nearly $2,000 in the first 24 hours of being created. So people were really invested in bringing this lovely young woman home. Now, as I said earlier on, Emma had two mobile phones. That's how she communicated. She relied on those two mobile phones very heavily for that communication. So police, they used the data from the phones to figure out where she has been. So what they discover is that she, or at least her phones, had travelled from the centre of the city towards Spencer Park, about 14 kilometres northeast of Christchurch, but then had gone back into the city. So when they work out the search area, basically it's a big area because the park itself spanned over 2,500 acres. So they've got a big search to carry out, and they do it. You know, they search extensively for Emma. Ground and helicopter searches were conducted in the areas of North Christchurch. This includes Spencer Park, but it also covered areas like the beach, the forest, wetland. They went round houses. They were desperate. And clearly at this point, they think something terrible has happened to Emma. There's also a specialist search of the Kate Valley landfill site. They organised that. And the investigators didn't actually say what they were looking for there, but they did reveal they were searching for Emma's belongings. So they were looking for her phones, they were looking for a handbag and sweatshirt. But even though they did this extensive searching, nothing of interest was actually found. Then they brought the divers in. So the divers start to do searches of the local waterways, and investigators start looking at data from other mobile phones because they wanted to determine if anybody else has actually taken a similar route to Emma that day. And though they did locate a phone, as far as the information about that phone, the tracking of it, that had followed a similar route to Emma, unfortunately it wasn't known who owned the phone, because so many of us register our phones, we're on contracts with our providers, so they exactly can identify who we are. If you don't have a phone that is connected to your name and address, and let's be honest, burner phones are out there every day of the week, they cannot find out who owns it. So even though they can see, look, this phone took the same route, which strongly suggests that that person would be with Emma, they can't identify the person who owns it. We get to the 21st of November 2007, and a prayer service is held for Emma at the New Brighton Pier at 7 a.m. Over 80 people attended, many of which were involved in the deaf community. And the main reason they turned up was because they just wanted Emma's family to know that they were supporting them. They just prayed that Emma was going to come home safely. And we have to remember that New Zealand is a very small population. So the fact that 80 people turn up to that prayer service, that's a lot of people. It demonstrates that the impact of a loss at this moment in time and the fear for her safety was really grave, and people really wanted to show that they were supportive of the family and also supportive of the hope, that Emma's going to be okay. Now we get to November the 23rd, 2007, and thank God, a match was found to the palm print found on Emma's car. So they find out that this palm print belongs to a man called Liam Reed. Also, they discover some pretty curious information about this guy, because he'd recently changed his name from Julian Heath Edgecombe. Now, I appreciate that people change their names for a whole heap of reasons. I get it. People get divorced and go back to their unmarried name. People, I don't know, fancy a bit of an unusual name and decide that their boring name isn't going to fit anymore. People change their lives and just want to reinvent themselves. All those things can happen. But also, people who want to create a whole new identity for themselves because they're a little bit naughty or nasty in their background can also do it for this reason. So this guy, Liam Reed, has now become this after being Julian Heath Edgecombe. And surprise, surprise, always known to police. He's got this criminal record. And so now they know they've got a guy who's changed his name, the criminal record. And there's a palm print on the car of a girl who's gone missing and whose car was found on fire. And there's no relationship between the two. He isn't a mechanic. No reason why his print should be there. Now, the problem is with this, that the print's on the exterior rather than the inside. So you can't say that just because that exists, there has to be a connection with her disappearance. As noted earlier on, it is quite possible that you could lean against somebody else's car, even when you shouldn't do. We've all seen kids doing that, for example. You're like, you walk out of a shop and you think, why are the six youths literally leaning on my car as if it's a park bench? And you just like slowly mosey on there and just hope they'll dissipate because you don't want to cause any comment. Is it just me who does that? Why challenge? I'm just like, when they see me putting my actual key in the door, they'll be like, oh, I'll get off this lady's car now. And it tends to be the case. But what I'm saying is I have...
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Several huge handprints on my car at that point. So I understand that's not enough to tie him to the crime, but they're obviously not going to let this go because this guy's got form. Then a witness informs the police that they actually had seen Liam hitchhiking in an area that was close to Spencer Park on the day after Emma went missing. So now at least that establishes that Liam could shed light potentially on what had happened to Emma because he was around the area. It might not be that he's saying he did it, but maybe he could give some indication of things that he'd seen that could lead to figuring out what had happened to her. On the 26th of November 2007, a witness came forward to say that Liam had confessed to them that he had done the deaf girl and that he'd actually killed her. Now, bear in mind, I struggle when people keep this kind of information to themselves, and we see this time and time again. A perpetrator will admit to a crime, and the person that they confess to will not actually go to the police. So it always really makes me happy when somebody has been given this kind of information, they haven't sat on their laurels, they haven't pretended that they haven't heard it, they haven't done nothing with it, they've actually gone straight to the authorities. So now, whilst it's hearsay, it's just another witness saying, this is what I've heard, it means that the police really are convinced that they do have their guy. So now the police have got the horrific information, and I'm sure that they're suspecting that something terrible has happened to Emma. And they can't absolutely be convinced that the person telling them this guy has killed her is the absolute truth, because we hear lots of times people staking claim for crimes they haven't committed just for the shock factor. But when you build the picture together, it really doesn't sound like the outcome is going to be positive for Emma or for Emma's family. And it isn't. Because on that very same day where the witness comes forward and says that Liam has admitted that he's killed Emma, they find her body. It's naked. She was found by a dog walker in Spencer Park in the Burwood Plantation. This was 11 days after she had disappeared, 11 days of torture that her family had to endure. And even though they'd searched that area and they genuinely thought they'd searched that area extensively, she was basically well hidden. So she'd been missed by the search teams. Bear in mind, when her body was found, it was dark. So the forensic team actually had to wait to analyse the scene the following day when they had the light. they found that twigs leading up to Emma's body had been broken, and there were marks in the grass, so that indicated the route that the actual killer had taken. But also, they found en route to that particular place that they found her, one of Emma's hairs in a tree. And that tree was actually high up, so it was 1.9 metres from the ground, because she was smaller than that, which indicated that she must have been being carried at the time. So you imagine on somebody's shoulders. At this point, the forensic team take samples from her body and from the scene around her body. And the problem we had with this is that, bear in mind, 11 days has passed, and that kind of period means the forensic evidence can degrade. So it means that because of the exposure to the elements, evidence could have been lost. First of all, no evidence is found on Emma's body. So that's a challenge. They want to be able to pin somebody to this crime. They think they have the suspect, but her body, as far as externally, hasn't actually given them any DNA. Then they do the autopsy, and it's harrowing. They find out that Emma had been suffocated. So a sock had been shoved into her mouth and down her throat. They were also able to see that she had indeed been sexually assaulted. I can't even imagine how harrowing her death would be. I think we all know how it feels to not be able to catch our breath, not be able to get enough oxygen into our lungs, to have a sock shoved into your mouth and down your throat. I would imagine that it was a real struggle for air, and it took longer for her to die than she would have should somebody have used a ligature, for example. It's just devastating to think that she died in that horrific way. We get to the 27th of November 2007, and police do go ahead and they arrest Liam Reid. This is during a raid that had been conducted by armed officers at a boarding house in Christchurch. And another witness at this point comes forward, and this regards an attack on a second woman. So this witness claims that Liam had actually told them he'd raped and tried to kill another person on the 24th of November in Dunedin. It's another area that I've been in, the South Island of New Zealand. Gorgeous people. I had such a safe experience in New Zealand. And yet here we are, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, these kind of human predators exist. It doesn't matter how safe you feel, they inhabit the shadows. Sometimes they inhabit our homes. The victim in this case was a 21-year-old student. And this 21-year-old student had apparently been strangled with a rope whilst she was being raped. So she had, by the grace of God, managed to escape, and she'd actually hit him in the testicles and then ran away. The only negative of that story is that this particular victim didn't have a scythe on her. Just a sharpened scythe. Oh, is that a scythe I see before me? The handle towards my hand, come let me clutch thee, whack. Just saying, that would have been a really good outcome for everyone. But this poor 21-year-old has had a harrowing experience but managed to get away. So police analyse the rope in the attack and find that the DNA corresponded to Liam. And also, DNA from under the victim's fingernails was also a match to him. And this particular victim went ahead and gave a very detailed description of the shoes which her attacker was wearing. And surprise, surprise, a similar pair belonging to Liam were tested. And guess what? Traces of blood belonging to that victim were found on these shoes too. So there was a huge amount of DNA evidence indicating that Liam was responsible for the attack on this young woman. Now, when the results from the analysis of the pubic hair found in Emma's car came back, in spite of them finding no DNA on her body, in spite of there being very little in the car, etc., fortunately, it was a really strong match to Liam Reid. So now we've got the DNA evidence also linking Liam to Emma's murder. And this, of course, also importantly supported the accusation that he had sexually assaulted her. And it's one of those things that you want to celebrate because now we've got him banged to rights, but you're also aware that all of this information is what the family are having to land and live with. You know, it's landing there with them, We know he abused her. We know he sexually assaulted her. That's horrific to hear. It's also validating because we know we're going to get justice. It's one of those double-edged swords. You want to know, but the knowledge is so agonising, and it must have been horrific for Emma's loving family. On October the 6th, 2007, we get the trial. And Liam pleads not guilty to the rape and murder of Emma. Of course he pleads not guilty. What else would we expect? Now, bear in mind, he's also at this point charged with the rape, murder and robbery of the Dunedin woman. But doesn't it just speak volumes about the arrogance, the narcissism, the sense of superiority that Liam has, that in spite of all this evidence giving an ABC map to his guilt, he still thinks that he can just say he's innocent and get away with it? Also, during the case, it's heard that Liam had a really violent history. He had had, and I kid you not, 61 prior convictions related to assault, robbery, and drugs. Well, he doesn't sound like a guilty party at all, does he? I mean, how did he have time to do anything else with that kind of level of conviction? When you have somebody who literally offends, just reoffends, and they're not removing or reducing that level of offending, we have a big problem when they're walking our streets. I'm all for a belief in second chances. The UK has a system that is all about believing people can change. When it comes down to psychopathic offenders, that's where it messes up because they can't. But for the average offender, with the right intervention, support and so on and so forth, they can change, and actually they do change. But they change because the consequences had an impact. If Liam has had 61 prior convictions related to assault, which is serious, robbery, which is serious. You think about robbery, it means I went up to you in the street and I literally mugged you. I stole stuff from you. I made you in fear of your life and took things. And also drugs. We are talking about a high level offender. Obviously, even a higher level offender when we're talking about the crime I'm talking about today. But what is happening that this kind of individual is walking the streets? Now, he'd previously been to prison because he'd been accused of abducting a woman and attempting to murder her during sex. M.O. right there. M.O. right there. That's his modus operandi. It's how he operates. But apparently, he was found not guilty of those charges, but he was convicted for using the alleged victim's bank card whilst on the run after she had reported him to the police. So the response here is they find him not guilty of the horrific rape, but he gets done for a bit of bank fraud, you know. I can't even begin to imagine how that victim felt. Undoubtedly, he will have tried to murder her. That's what we're talking about today. The fact that this man does those things. And all he got was basically a slap on the wrist. So he was given 3 months in prison for this in 2002. What a deterrent. But also, let me tell you, what we know research-wise is that if you are a violent perpetrator and you try to cause great harm to another human being, let's even put it in the context that he wasn't trying to kill her, although the victim believed that he was. Let's say it wasn't his intention. Let's say he only gets done for the victim's bank card situation. Nonetheless, the consequence is he gets put in prison. Now, what a violent perpetrator will often do is up the way they act in the crime to prevent that happening again. And the only way you can stop a victim telling the police about what you've done is if you kill them, if you silence them. So sadly, what research indicates is when people don't get away with a crime, even though he got away with the bigger crime in this case, if they don't get away with the crime and they end up in prison, they don't like it. They don't like people having power over them. So when they reoffend again in that violent, sadistic, sexual way, they kill. So that slap on the wrist still introduced to him what it's like to have no control and power and to have your freedom taken away. So the likelihood is he felt, I will never let that happen to me again. Also, whilst he's in prison for all of 3 months, he attacked numerous other inmates. Apparently he hit one of them with a broom, bashed another one over the head and repeatedly punched another in the face. Also threw boiling water in the face. We are talking about a stone-cold psychopath. Can we just put it out there? Stone-cold psychopath. If you can't even behave appropriately when you're in prison for a very short period of time so that you can protect your fate on the outside, i.e. being released, it's because you don't care about consequences. You just care about power, authority, and domination. And boy, that's very clear from what I'm talking about today. Let's just talk about the psychological examinations that happen on Liam whilst he is awaiting trial, because there's a whole heap of wrong going on. First of all, he admits, I really did have the urge to kill animals in my childhood. MacDonald Triad, tick. You know, number one, the very fact that he feels comfortable saying, well, you know what, I did have the urge, to kill animals. And also to say he found it satisfying, which means I killed animals, because you don't find something satisfying unless you've done it. That is enough for me to be like, oh, I'm just going to lock you up forever. Honestly, you could come, if I was in that situation, being somebody doing those analyses, and this is why I never would be. Sorry, Emma, we just got your report. Yeah. Do you like it? I mean, Emma, it's well written. It's diligently written. Thank you. I like to take time with my reports because I do think it's very important that bad people aren't walking the streets. Yes, I know. I have noted that you have suggested that we keep this individual in prison indefinitely. Yes, I am. I've written that note saying must only ever leave prison in a box. Yes, Emma, I appreciate that. And can I just ask why you've come to those conclusions? Mm-hmm, I can. So the reason I've come to those conclusions is because this particular prisoner suggested to me that they had an enjoyment for killing hamsters and for microwaving mice. So that's my conclusion. Yes, Emma, I appreciate that's your conclusion. We do agree that it's not very nice that he does those things and that there will be some repercussions for that kind of behaviour should he ever be caught doing it. But I don't think that stealing a meal deal from Tesco is really a reason to keep somebody in for the rest of their lives till they leave in a box. Well, that's where you and I differ. That's kind of what would happen. So anyway, my own feelings aside, the fact is he's telling in the psychological examinations the psychologist that these urges to kill, and obviously that he went ahead and killed, satisfied him. But he also said that he believed that killing women would be better. Genuinely, is this not the point where we bring in that Hannibal Lecter's glass box and just put him in a straitjacket forever and throw away the key? Just like feed him through small holes. Again, I know that that's not going to happen. I'm just saying it really disturbs me when people feel at peace saying this kind of stuff in psychological examinations. But anyway, here we are. He believed that killing women would be better, and he pictured himself squeezing someone's head until it popped, because that's not completely atypical and bizarre, is it? Also, he said he couldn't be straight to save himself, and he wanted to live a vigilante life, which really annoys me because, you know what, just go screw yourself saying that you want a vigilante lifestyle. Now, I'm not into vigilante behaviour, although there are certain circumstances where I do imagine a good lynching of a child killer might not go amiss. I know we can't. I'm just saying there are moments where I feel provoked for such things. What I'm talking about is, the word vigilante is associated with taking the law into your own hands. It means that somebody has acted in a way that is completely out of order, and the repercussions are dealt with by those who are not legally or professionally employed to deal with those situations. So when you see paedophile hunters online posting footage of people who met children when they knew that their ages were way underage, and that occurs, that's vigilante behaviour. Some people agree with it, some people don't agree with it. Nonetheless, it's about finding justice for those individuals who are being affected by criminal behaviour. You can't say you're a vigilante when you're going out and murdering innocent women. There's no.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I've gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Vigilante, in that you're a criminal, you're a murderous rapist and criminal. That's it. But this is the way he's portraying himself. He also said that he had these really sadistic fantasies. He liked the adrenaline of outrunning the police and that he wanted to become a serial rapist and murderer. And a lot of people might look at that and think to themselves, well, why on earth is he admitting all of this to the actual psychologists? Well, what we know about these kind of offenders is often the arrogance that they have comes from a sense of superiority, a sense of courage that they don't believe other people have, a sense that somehow what they are doing makes them special. So whilst it means that they're also admitting guilt and that they're also putting themselves in a very precarious situation regarding sentencing, because this kind of stuff's going to come out in court, what it also suggests is that firstly, they like the fact they're doing something that's wrong. Secondly, they don't take accountability and responsibility for their behaviours because they think their behaviour is acceptable. Thirdly, they want people to know who they are. They want to be notorious. They want to be seen loud and proud for their crimes. And fourthly, they like talking about it because it accentuates and extends the feeling of dominance and power that they want to relive again and again and again and again. They want to be seen as the loudest, proudest, scariest, most despicable serial killer of all time because they feel that gives them some visibility in a world where they would otherwise be completely invisible because there is nothing notable or special about this man at all. And even though they're talking about something that means that 99.99% of the population find them malevolent, disgusting, despicable, reprehensible, deserving of nothing. In their warped logic, this actually means they stand out. Now, the court, they're told that both of the women had basically been subjected to rough sex and that this was considered a signature. We all are aware of what a signature is. A signature is what the offender does to emotionally and psychologically gratify themselves. It's got nothing to do with the killing itself. It's to do with something that serves a purpose to titillate them. So both of these victims had really deep genital bruising as a result. And you don't need to do that to rape somebody or kill somebody. You do that. It's an additional part of the harm. It's an additional part of the sadism. It leaves marks and it says, this is a very similar case to another. That's how we link signatures. They can be physical, i.e. you leave it like a pentagram where somebody like Richard Ramirez is concerned, or where it's physical. Think about BTK and the way that he bound people. It's a signature. It's unique to that offender. Now, Liam, he did something that I find deeply satisfying when it came down to the court case. He spoke in his own defence. And I do like it when an offender does this because I often think that they believe they can hoodwink a jury and that somehow the jury are going to be like, oh, Liam's a really nice guy. He's sweet as. I don't even know why he's in this courtroom. He's a really good guy. We should just let him go now. anyway. He speaks in his own defense. And this is what his defense is. You're going to love it. He was set up. Yeah, he was set up. So basically he says, listen, I didn't do any of it. The police have planted evidence that was being used against me. I never met Emma. I never drove anywhere with her. And he claimed on the day of the murder, he'd basically driven to get drugs with a friend who he refused to name. Not being funny. Your defence is already destabilised when you forget to bring in the witness who could identify that you were with them. But I don't know. Maybe he's just being a really loyal friend. I'm not going to give my mate up. Not a chance. Sorry, this accent's terrible. I know. I'm just trying to portray it in a bit more of a dramatic sense. So anyway, he doesn't bring the person who would clearly be able to go, oh yeah, yeah, I was definitely with him, because apparently it's a drugs thing, so he doesn't want to dob him in, essentially. Also, he claimed that on the day he was pretty wired because he'd injected P. Well, it's actually methamphetamine is what we're talking about. And he said, when I woke up in November, on November the 15th, I had no idea I would get framed for the murder 2 weeks later. No, you're not getting framed. It's because you've literally got your pubic hair in the car, you absolute reprobate. But anyway, this is the story. You can imagine, can't you? Like, the prosecution are just all there rubbing their hands together, like, get him on the stand, get him on the stand. I get to cross-examine him. And the defence are going, Liam, maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe you could just take a step back from this and let us handle it. And him going, I was framed and that's my defence. As if that's going to get anybody else. As if the jury are going to be like, oh my God, here we are. It's another police brutality case. It's another case where the police have gone out of their way to find some innocent guy with 61 prior offences and just fit him up for a crime. Also planting a piece of his pubic hair in the back seat. Yeah, it totally makes sense. We should totally acquit him. Anyway, as you would imagine, in spite of his clearly brilliant statements in court, his fabulous defence that I'm sure he presented, he gets found guilty. So October the 31st, 2007, he's found guilty of the rape and he's also found guilty of the murder of Emma.
I'm not making stuff up as I go along. This is the way it is. Absolutely, I'm not telling you what his name is.
And he could get you off a charge of murder?
No, I can get myself off a charge of murder with the help of my lawyers. You can't place me anywhere near Emma Agnew. You can't place me anywhere near Spencer Park. A pubic hair could have come from anywhere. It could be transference. It could be that it blew in from the street when somebody opened the door. And it would be a mistake to... for you guys to say that the police don't do that sort of thing. I don't need to explain myself to you, who I was with, what I was doing, whatever, because you can't prove otherwise, so...
But just to get this clear, you're not going to tell us who you were with.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to tell us where you went.
I don't need to.
And also the rape, indecent assault, robbery and attempted murder of the young woman in Dunedin. Bang to rights, mate. Screw you with your defence. You didn't have one. The good guys got you and there was no going back. Now, it took the jury just 4 hours to reach their decision and he was actually given an automatic life sentence. Now, later, he was sentenced to preventative detention, which means that he'd only be released when and if he was considered to be a non-threat to society, essentially. So even though there is a potentially get parole, it would have to be that they'd considered that he would never be a threat again. And I don't think you can have a case like this where an individual can go to prison and change their ways. I don't. He's a psychopath, pure and simple. And the idea that somebody who has literally tried to murder numerous people, and let's be honest, has probably or potentially got away with murdering other people. You think about the kind of MO, you think about his absolute comfort with murdering. There's a strong chance he could have killed more people than Emma. It could just be that he got caught for the murder of Emma. And you think about his background as a child, murdering, killing animals, his absolute fantasies that he's proud of, wanting to harm women, wanting to squeeze them so hard that their head popped, the brutality that lives in his mind. How is he ever going to change? This guy is a stone-cold psychopath every day of the week. And as far as I'm concerned, he should never be paroled. Now, he was given a minimum non-parole term of 26 years. That's the second longest sentence to be given in New Zealand. I know that people in America will be laughing at that sentence, because in America it would have been, you're going down for life, mate, and that means life is life. But in New Zealand, much like in the UK, the term life shouldn't be used, because often it means that you're out after a relatively short amount of time. I mean, in the UK, we're talking for just over a decade. Sometimes people go to prison for murder. So that doesn't really feel like life at all. But at least 26 years, he's definitely going to be inside. And like I said, they will have to agree that he's going to be safe to walk the streets. It won't be an automatic release after that time. So let's hope to God that either something happens to him in prison where he just rots away and never gets out, or that the parole board never believe that he's safe ever to walk the streets. Because no woman is going to be safe walking the streets if he's there. When the judge summed up in his sentencing, he called Liam arrogant. He said, "You sought to dominate women." He said, "You are not without intelligence. That is one of the dangers that underlies your activities. Sadly, there is not the slightest flicker of remorse." And we have to remember, guys, Emma's deafness made her even more vulnerable to Liam's evil designs. And the judge said, "You were not deterred. You raped her. You murdered her. I am perfectly satisfied that it was violent to the extreme. These were callous and despicable acts." And when the judge went on to talk about the attack on the woman in Dunedin, the judge actually said that Liam had dragged his victim across a car park by her hair. And he said, "Just like an animal would with its prey." He said that Liam was an evil and dangerous predator. And he commented that it would take a miraculous transformation before women would be safe if he was ever back on the streets. And I think that's an understatement. It would be terrifying to imagine this man could ever walk free. Now, when this was happening, Liam bowed and waved as the gallery applauded in response to his sentence. And he actually raised his hands in celebration as he was led out of the court. At this point, is it possible to just bring in, I don't know, some heavy objects and close the doors just as he's got his leaving hat on? I'm just leaving. Just gonna, oh, I'm raising my hands, I'm celebrating, oh, it's really funny, I'm bowing, etc. And oh, I gotta get out of this door. Why can't I get out of this door? Why has everybody got bricks in their hands? Why does that judge have a black cloth on his head? Anyway, I digress. Sorry, I'm going into one of my fantasy modes again. You all know what I mean though. Genuinely, the disrespect, the disregard of humanity that a perpetrator who has carried out such a heinous crime in the most brutal of ways to multiple people, and yet in that moment where the sentence is passed, and it's a sentence that is very, very long, and ultimately he knows he's losing his freedom, in that moment, he just wants to humiliate the victim's family to some degree by acting like he doesn't care. Now, I know that the family in that moment are also acknowledging that he is going away for a very long time. But what he's doing is he is totally disregarding Emma and his other victim. He doesn't care. He's saying, I don't care. This is funny. It's tragic that human beings like this inhabit our earth. But this is how he leaves. Hands out in celebration as he's led out of the court. A member of Emma's family actually spat at him from the gallery, and I think that he got off very, very easily. And the woman that he attacked in Dunedin, she said thank God when he received his sentence, and rightfully so, because her life must have been blighted so badly by this. Speaking outside of the court, Emma's brother Toby said, "I feel like it's just not fair. We can't bring our sister back to life, and it's changed our life forever." Her father, Henry, commented that the family were very relieved by the verdict, but obviously they're still deeply disappointed this man gets to breathe another day and live another day. Her father said, "We miss Emma so much, but we are a very close family, so we will just keep going." And that's a powerful statement. It's saying to Liam, you may have destroyed an element of who we are, but you have not destroyed who we are. And let's be honest, the love that they show for Emma, she will have been blessed with a lifetime's full in her short years, unlike somebody like Liam, who no one will ever truly love. You won't be surprised that, as ever, Liam Reid appealed his conviction. It was denied, but even though it was denied, he was partially successful because he appealed his sentence. As his non-parole period at the time, I said, was 26 years, they reduced that to 23 years. This is shocking. I genuinely think sometimes that people in legal positions are slightly unhinged. Why would you reduce a man's sentence that I think is incredibly lenient, 26 years to 23 years? What does that say about Emma's life? What does that say about her loss? What does that say about her value? What is the message that you're giving to her family? You remove 3 years of their sanity, their security. You steal that from them for what? For this absolute POS. But I don't control that. I'm just telling you the information. However, you want to go even a little bit more deep into shocks, because boy, we are going to talk about major shocking news. Because in 2013, Davina Murray, who was Liam's lawyer, attended court because she had been charged with smuggling a phone, cigarettes and a lighter to Liam whilst he was in prison. And why? Well, she was accused of having communication with a prisoner that may prejudice the safe custody of a prisoner. So she was charged with smuggling a phone, cigarettes and a lighter to Liam whilst he was in prison. This is his lawyer. His lawyer. Just think about this. His lawyer was charged with smuggling a phone, cigarettes and a lighter to Liam while he was in prison. She was also accused of having a communication with a prisoner that may prejudice the safe custody of a prisoner. So she ends up getting convicted for smuggling the contraband and was subject to a Law Society investigation. Rightfully so, because, sweetheart, you're going to lose your right to practice. End of. That's a massive malpractice. But then, let's just get to even more slightly insane. Yes, in 2015, rightly so, she gets struck off the role of barristers and solicitors of the High Court of New Zealand. As I said, it's malpractice, it's gross misconduct, she should. But in 2017, Davina, Liam Reid's lawyer, married him. I kid you not. Sometimes I think that I've gone into a weird universe where stuff like this actually happens. Because I just don't think in the rational universe this would happen. But Davina didn't get the memo. Bear in mind that Davina is a highly qualified academic. It ain't no easy feat getting to be a lawyer or a barrister. Under no circumstances is that simple. But you would think, I don't know. I'm just going to throw it out there, guys. If you are qualified to this level, I would think you'd be like, probably, when it comes down to a list of no-nos, just let's go through a few of the obvious ones. Probably shouldn't take contraband into a prison, you know, particularly when I'm representing an individual who's in that prison. Probably a bit naughty. You know, don't do it. We're not talking about a packet of mints on a day that you're not allowed to pass a packet of mints over, are we? We're not talking about a little pack of cards. Take a pack of cards. I'm not allowed a pack of cards. Got to buy it from the regulated buying authority in prison. Just take the pack of cards, put them on the sleeve. All I'm saying is they would still not probably be acceptable in certain circumstances. I do think mints are acceptable. But what I'm saying is when it comes down to cigarettes and a mobile phone, etc., that, when you are a lawyer, is something that is pretty much picked upon in the first day of your training. You know? Don't have inappropriate relationships with prisoners. But surely, the memo about don't marry a rapist and a murderer, that's got to be somewhere in your training. And that would be a terrible thing to do, right? Terrible. But that's what she does. Yes, she thinks to herself, in for a penny, in for a pound. I'll just pop over to Paramoremo prison and marry Liam in a secret ceremony. Not that secret. Obviously, it got all over the press. Did she go out and pick a little dress? You know, were people asking whether she was going to have a hen do? Oh, Davina, you're looking a bit excited. I am excited. Why are you excited? Well, I'm getting married. Really? Yeah, can't wait. Who is he? Oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who he is. The point is I'm a... I'm in love. Well, are we not going to meet him? No, you're not going to meet. Well, you can meet him. All I'm going to say is a bit of an issue with meeting him. You're going to need a VO. What's a VO, Davina? It's a visitor's order because he's a rapist and a murderer. Step away from Davina. Davina makes very bad choices. Anyway, genuinely goes through with it. And there were actually text read.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
At the hearing about whether she was fit to practice, which you're not, Davina, sweetheart. And the text said, when they were sent to a friend, that Liam was the best kisser I've ever kissed and described him as seriously the best. I mean, who wouldn't want her representing you? Clearly, she is absolutely unhinged. Unhinged. Who in their right mind marries a rapist and a murderer? He's guilty as hell. There is something delusional about a mindset that goes ahead and does that. I appreciate that some people have got a sexual paraphernalia about this kind of relationship, but man, she has dealt with the worst of the worst. She's been privy to all the information about this monster and yet she married him. Wow. She went on about the marriage itself and wrote, "My heart says I should just do it, but my head says white." Because it could affect Liam's appeal, right? Whoever your mate is, they need to be writing back to you and going, "Davina, you need to check into rehab for some kind of emotional trauma because something is kicking off within you. What you are doing and thinking and being is ridiculous. Step away from the ring." She also went on to say, "He makes me laugh. He makes me think. He makes me cry. He makes me feel beautiful. He makes me sing." None of us want to hear that, Davina. None of us want to hear your song because you would remind me of somebody going into a scenario completely delusionally. So if you sing, it will be like when people go on The X Factor because, I don't know, the great aunt told them that they were brilliant at singing all their life, even though everyone else has never paid much attention because they sound like a drowning cat. That's the kind of person you are. Sorry. But it really frustrates me when we're talking about somebody who is a defense attorney who literally marries this horrific man, this horrific killer, and it's the message that that sends to Emma's family. It really is. It's the message that that sends to Emma's family, and they're the victims in this. What is she thinking? Anyway, it takes all sorts in this life, but it shouldn't take somebody who's actually working in the legal field, and she should never be allowed to practice law. Now, Corrections Minister Louise Upton, they described the marriage as particularly disgraceful and appalling and revolting, and said that most New Zealanders would feel the same way. They would. New Zealand's an awesome country with awesome people. Don't blame me, New Zealanders, for the terrible accent that I did today. I apologise massively in advance. I love New Zealand. I enjoyed my time there. I did lose my camper van on one particular occasion. It did take me 24 hours nearly to find it, and it was very distressing. But nonetheless, that trauma aside, it's a beautiful place. But I know that one of the most beautiful things about my time in New Zealand was every single Sunday when I went to church, somebody took me home. And I was given showers and food, and it was incredible. I have only good thoughts and feelings about that country, and I agree. They would find it appalling and revolting that this human being had married that monster. She also said that it's a tragic day for Emma's family, as they would never see their daughter get married because of him, and yet somehow he gets to get married. Victims' advocates referred to the marriage as delusional. We're all on the same page. And Liam's ex-partner was also completely outraged that the ceremony was allowed to take place, particularly because it actually occurred on the birthday of her daughter, who Liam had fathered. But hey, there's no sense, there's no feeling, there's nothing. Just two delusional idiots marrying one another. One who somehow thinks that the guy she's got is a good catch, and another one who's a psychopathic maniac who genuinely believes that, you know, at the end of the day, choking women to death until the head pops off is a good thing. What more can we say? And the mother of Liam's child also said that she just felt sick and sad for her daughter, who she said had not only had to come to terms with what he'd done at a very young age, but that would also eventually grow up knowing that he was a rapist and a murderer. But now, every birthday from now on, they would have to know that those two were celebrating their wedding anniversary. She said to do this to her was cruel and heartless. But hey, that's another commonality. Davina and Liam, cruel and heartless. So just stands to reason they do this. Now in 2022, showing her true colours further, Davina appealed the decision to strike her from the role, applying for restoration. Imagine how that went, got you guys. Oh, I've just got something in from Davina. Do you remember Davina, the person who defended that monster Liam Reed? Oh yeah, I do remember Davina, yeah. It was a hard case and he tried to defend himself and he came across like an absolute fool and it was obvious he was guilty. Yeah, yeah, that Davina. Well, anyway, she wants us to restore her license to practice. Just run me through why we struck her off. Oh, she married Liam Reed. Oh, just going to get my big rubber stamp here. Denied! And that's what happened. Imagine it went like this. Denied, 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 denied. Maybe they found Davina and they put it on her head too. Denied! Anyway, thankfully, it was denied. And it was considered that she had abused her professional privilege and also that she doesn't bloody recognise that her crime was serious. And of course, her response to this was that the decision to dismiss her appeal reflects the inherent prejudice towards criminal barristers. What? What planet are you on? Well, planet Davina is where she's on. But basically, that's what she's saying. That you treating me, this barrister, unfairly because I fell in love with a convicted monstrous murderer who I also smuggled contraband in for, me breaking all of the rules of my cloak and my bar and my profession, you are being prejudicial towards me because your expectations are I should know how to behave and that's not fair. You should feel sorry for me. I'm just human. Anyone can marry a monstrous murderer and struggle contrabanded and you're just being nasty. I'm not saying she said it like that, but that's the mindset. She went on to say she had worn the cloak of shame for long enough and deserved to practice law again. Well, no, you don't. That's like somebody who commits the crime going, at the end of the day, it's not fair that you sent me to prison for this long. I've been in here 4 weeks. You should let me out. I've had to wear the cloak of shame of an offender for like this long and I've had enough. Just do one, Davina. I should have a t-shirt with do one Davina put on and send it to her. Apparently she's just worn the cloak of shame enough time now and she deserves to have a well-paying job again. No, not gonna happen. Nada, not a chance, mate. She is clearly extremely delusional. So this case has been a weird one because yes, we got the right guy and by God, does he deserve to rot in hell and he will. The hell of Ata will be ready for him at the end of his days without a doubt. But it seems like this time he'll have a mate with him. Good old Davina, because it appears that she hasn't got a conscience either. So when it comes down to it, they are pretty good bedfellows, aren't they? And let's hope that they carry on leading a happy, distorted, monstrous life together. Because if anything, somehow, these two really did manage to find their perfect reflection. I hope to God that he spends the rest of his life in pain. That's all I'm saying, guys. Thoughts to Emma. Thoughts to that victim. Thoughts to everybody affected by this case. Davina, pop off and get some therapy, mate, for 100 years. Maybe by then you'll realise what a warped perspective you have in this world. Take care, guys. See you again next time.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe. love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.